I mean, I think you all can tell from the title of this episode, there are content warnings across the board. Rape, statutory rape, murder, mental health, just everything. Throw the whole cutlery drawer at it. We are in for a ride. Greetings, Attic Wives, and welcome to Fuck Boys of Literature. I'm your host, Emily Edwards. If you're a longtime listener, you know by now that I don't pick the books we do every episode, but the guest does. Mostly, that's just so the onus of reading or rereading fresh for the recording session is on me. People normally choose books they love or have recently finished in order to not have to read 400 pages of Victorian sadness again and again. And I admit, I have rarely said no to a book that someone chose to discuss. But I almost said no to this one. I hadn't read it since college. I didn't get it. I was too uncomfortable. But I should have known that my guest wouldn't lead me astray. You all are in for a phenomenal episode. All right, everyone. With me today is the best-selling author of The Collected Schizophrenias and the novel The Border of Paradise, Esme Weijin Wang. How the hell are you?
I'm hanging in there. How are you doing today as we get ready to talk about this particular fuckboy?
You know, I'm apprehensive just because this is such a loaded book for so many people. What is your background with it? Because I feel like the earlier people started reading this book, the more complex their relationship to it as they get older.
Yes, I think it's one of those books. So, you know, we should probably say this is Lolita.
Yes.
The book is Lolita. And I feel that I had an experience with this book that is similar to many people's experience, which is that I read it, I came to it at many different points in my life, right. And every time I felt very differently about it.
Yeah.
I remember reading it first in high school because I did my senior thesis in high school about Nabokov. And, so I wrote about like three or four books of his.
Oh, wow.
And one of them was Lolita. And I remember not being as disturbed by it as I would be in later years. I feel like my level of skittishness or disturbance regarding this book has fluctuated throughout the years. I think that Humbert as a prose stylist really kind of overwhelmed any ickiness I might have felt in the beginning. Just the prose is so gorgeous that I just admired it so much on that level. And so, my relationship to its actual content has also changed. So, it's one of my favorite books. And I also really liked the Jeremy Irons, Dominique Swain movie at one point in my life, which we talked about briefly before we started recording. And so, yeah, this book was also a huge influence on my first novel, or at least one character in my first novel, the kind of obsessiveness and the voice. That's a little bit of my introduction to Lolita.
That makes a lot of sense because like when you're an older teenager, like I was not a very good student. I will say that. I tried very hard. I got good grades, but I wasn't like actively as participatory in reading as I was now as a much older adult. So the first time I read this, I was in my last semester of college, so you can only imagine how little attention I paid to the actual text. So it is very much like a ruminatory sort of obsessive writing style where the descriptions of Humbert's life and his opinions on things really just cascade like a waterfall at you. And it's very easy to sort of gloss over the meanings of what he's saying, which is that he's obsessed with a 12-year-old girl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the obsession and the grotesqueness of certain scenes. I'm thinking especially of the one where he steals a spasm, the honeyed spasm, or like mm-hmm. the honey of a spasm, while she's sitting in his lap. I mean, it's such a grotesque scene, but yeah. the language is so, I don't know, I think some would say purple, but it's so florid that yeah. it's easy to forget how horrifying the narrative is, which is in part why I think it's interesting to talk about the movies when thinking about this book, because the movies make more plain, I think, the horrors of the book in a way that prose can kind of overwhelm.
I think that's a really good point, especially, you know, I had not really connected it to like the grotesqueness of it. I just, this go round, there's a moment where he's talking about just standing casually next to Lolita at some point, and he's talking about like pinching a bug bite that she has and like sucking out the venom. And that point just grossed me out to, you know, there's no other word for it, where I was just like, that's disgusting. But, you know, the bodily nature of his description of everything is incredibly off-putting as someone who doesn't read a lot of, you know, I don't read romance novels. I don't read a lot of things that boil down to, you know, like a lot of like bodies and fluids and stuff like that, where you get in like a lot of like heavy descriptions when things like horror and romance novels and things like that. So I was really very put off at first, of course, by the fact that, you know, I am a 35-year-old adult woman going, you know, she is 12, just constantly in the back of your head. Mm-hmm. But then just the nature of his descriptions of how he's obsessed with her feet. He's obsessed with her dirty feet. He's obsessed with how noisily she eats. It's mm-hmm. constantly looking to the grossest nature of a body in a way that I really was not prepared for.
He's also very charmed by her grossness in some ways, in part because she is such a kind of rollicking, just kind of free kid, at least when he first meets her. I'm thinking specifically of a scene in the Jeremy Irons movie that I find absolutely heartbreaking, but that is not as obvious in the book or is glossed over in maybe one sentence, which is when you can tell that that Dolores is crying herself to sleep mm-hmm. in I think one of the motel rooms, and mm-hmm. To have that scene in film is very different I think than having Humbert notice it in passing. Mm-hmm. He's very, I think, I don't know, would you use the term unreliable narrator to describe him?
I wouldn't, I don't think, just because I think he's very reliable in telling us how he feels and why he feels the way he does. And since this is not like Dolores's story, it is not Lolita's story, she is not the purpose of this book, I think he's incredibly honest with us about his history with why he feels the way he does what he does, why,
or what his assumptions, though,
exactly,
or his guesses as to why, where this came from.
I think it's valid for someone to say, like, these are my motivations. You might think mine are something completely different, but this is why I feel I'm doing what I'm doing. And, you know, I think the book also gives us a better window into Lo's neglect while she's with her mother that the movies kind of gloss over quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, her mother is not a particularly sympathetic woman. I actually think she's portrayed really well in the Jeremy Irons movie.
I agree.
Who is that actress?
It's again? Melanie Griffith in that movie.
Yes, Melanie Griffith. I think she does a really good job of portraying the mother and just how fixated she is on this man and how annoyed she is, how perpetually annoyed she is by her daughter.
Yeah, she has this tendency to, especially in that film, but also very much in the text of the book, to make no means to hide the fact that she is an aspirational American woman, where she wants to be fancier, richer, better cultured, you know, than she actually is. And the tackiness of her character in the Jeremy Irons movie, where she's like speaking bad French at him, she's trying to give him like luxuriant foods. It's very indicative of this character. And it goes into very much the fuckboy nature. Like, I try to make a very distinct delineation between like fuckboy and just straight up villain, whereas like he is both, because Humbert so thoroughly believes that he is the pinnacle of manhood. That is something that I never saw in this text before.
Yeah, he really believes in his own handsomeness. He believes in his own classiness. He is deeply invested in the fact that he's from Europe and that America is this kind of rude and uncultured place, which I feel like is reflected in the road trip. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really good line to draw, though, between being a fuckboy and being a villain.
Yeah, I think more often than not, when people suggest characters for this show, they're just like deeply evil people, and it's like, well, no, there's a difference. Humbert is not a good person. He is chasing after a 12-year-old girl. It is really not good. He is a rapist through and through. There's no beating around that bush. Everybody knows that. But I think that there is we forget often in discussing him in that large that like Humbert had a trail leading up to this, you know, his obsession with the perfect little girl in his youth and how just like every single aspect of his youth was considered perfect, 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 and how he has no flaws whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. And he has a relationship with an adult woman who ends up cheating on him with a cab driver.
Yes.
And that relationship, I think, is also something that gets overlooked in talking about this book.
Yeah, when he's in Paris, I believe, he marries a Polish woman whom he says just basically immediately let herself go. And, you know, he had no choice but to detest her because, you know, within weeks of their marriage, you know, she had somehow, you know, become fat and ugly and terrible. And he's just like, what choice did I have but to like basically threaten to murder her? And you're like, wait a goddamn minute.
Yeah. It's kind of, you know, I was kind of glad when she escaped with the cab driver.
Yeah.
He probably, he didn't seem that great, but, you know, probably better than this adult man who was constantly lusting after young girls.
Yeah.
But yeah, the description of the way that he describes Dolores's mom, Mrs. Hayes, but I can't remember her
Charlotte.
First name. Charlotte, yes. The way he describes her, I think, has a very fuckboy nature to it.
Yeah.
It says, I think I had better describe her right away to get it over with. The poor lady was in her middle 30s. She had a shiny forehead, plucked eyebrows, and quite simple but not unattractive features of a type that may be defined as a weak solution of Marlene Dietrich.
Oh, God. Whenever we read a book and they're like, that woman was so aged and decrepit, she was 35. I'm always like, oh, thank you. Thank you for that.
Yes.
I appreciate it.
Same. Yeah.
But he's older too. You know, I think he's 38 at the start of the book, and he just – he's one of those men who fully believes that like men age like wine and women age like cheese, and you just it's unrelenting how highly he thinks of himself with his movie star good looks and his Parisian in his French, which gets actually pushed into the narrative more and more as the book goes on. Like he holds back on the French in the beginning, and then toward the end, like there are huge passages where it's like every other sentence is in French, and it's very jarring as an American reader.
He also tends to glom on to other people finding him attractive. He's kind of disgusted by Charlotte being attracted to him and wanting to marry him, but he's also, I think, in some ways flattered. There's the image of the movie star that Dolores has, I believe, taped to her wall, her bedroom wall, and he admires the fact that he resembles this movie star in Charlotte or in Dolores's eyes. I do think that, weirdly, to get back to the movie, and I will say the reason I keep referring to the Jeremy Irons movie is that I really liked that movie when I was younger, and I also never saw the Kubrick movie. Not for any particular reason, but that I was very captivated by Dominic Swain's performance in the later movie, and I also had heard that her performance was much more, I don't know, perhaps more true to the book. Anyway.
No, it's a very good adaptation of the book, for the fact that I don't know where James Mason ranked on the like 1960s hunky actor, you know, stratosphere, but it is a little bit weird just to hear James Mason's voice try to sound sexy and be you know, I like James Mason, but I don't know again where he ranked on that. But Jeremy Irons is very, very good casting for Humbert Humbert, and Dominic Swain was very, very good, very good in the movie. It actually didn't kill her career in a way that it probably would have. She's still a working actress. She, you know, so her IMDb credits list is very long. So good for her. Whoever her manager is steered her out of that quagmire very well.
Yeah. I mean, I remember reading that Natalie Portman had been considered for the role, but that her parents would not allow her to do the movie.
But they let her do The Professional when she was 12.
Yeah, The Professional is not like Lolita in its way.
I just feel terrible about the fact that, you know, that basically Lolita has become shorthand for problematic girls in a way that Humbert has not become shorthand for deeply abusive and problematic men.
Yes. And also a sexiness. Kind of, you know, problematic, sexy young thing. It has become synonymous with.
Which, when you read the book, doesn't even make sense for how Humbert views her, because he says off the bat that his chosen, you know, he uses the word nymphettes, which is really disgusting, and it makes me cringe every single time. He says that they don't know that they're sexy, and that's part of the appeal.
He is very specific about what a nymphette is, and yes, that is quite disgusting. But yes, he's very specific. It's not necessarily the most attractive young girl. It's often a girl who is not aware of her attractiveness, as you said. He admires the other schoolgirls. He says the median age of pubescence for girls has been found to be 13 years and 9 months in New York and Chicago, which is somewhat hilarious. Why New York and Chicago? Anyway. What do you think of Humbert's portrayal of Dolores's flirtatiousness in the book and how the word Lolita has become synonymous with kind of a young, seductive girl.
I have no doubt that if Humbert was actually even a third as of attractive as he believes he was, that a very lonely, forgotten 12-year-old girl would try to win his favor. I think that, you know, the way that Charlotte is described in the book and her relationship to Lo is very upsetting as a modern person, even as a person who doesn't have children. Like Humbert says that when he goes into their marriage bedroom for the first time, Charlotte only has one photo in her entire bedroom, and it's of a son she lost as a baby. And she has no love whatsoever for Lo, and she hates her and sees her as competition very clearly. Whether or not that's a construct of Humbert, we can't tell. I feel like it's probably fairly accurate. And so for Lo to try to get attention from the only other adult in her house, I think makes perfect sense. He's viewing it as flirtation, as sexualized, because he wants it to be, but I don't think it is.
And when I'm thinking about the scene in the car, after he picks her up from the camp, and she's talking about what a bad girl she's been, essentially. I immediately weirdly think of the Fiona Apple song Criminal,
actually perfectly accurate.
She talks about, she's kind of hinting to him that she's been sexually active in some way, and you know, I think any more sane man, I don't know if sane is the word, somebody with a little bit more reasonableness, would not take that as he does, which is a cue.
A come on, an invitation. I think it's fairly clear as you're reading the book that all of that is a lie, and that she has no real sexual experience. Like maybe she's kissed a few boys and, like, as they used to say in the mid-century, heavy petting. But like, I think it's fairly obvious that like all of that is a fabrication as the time goes on, just because she, you know, she talks about how he hurts her and how she's not comfortable with things that are happening, but he just, you know, he just barreled Rose right through it. And I think the fact that the movie is set in the late 1940s through the early 1950s is also very important for the fact that she reads film magazines constantly. And the film industry at the time, you know, there was such a stark delineation between childhood and adulthood. And there's no media for 12-year-olds in the 1940s. She's going from things that are for babies and to teach you how to count and what your colors are to Hays Code, you know, levels of romance where no one has sex. It's just kissing, and you can't even kiss for that long because of the Hays Code. There's no divorce. There's nothing. Everything is beautiful and nothing hurts in like Hays Code era films. So why wouldn't she think that this handsome man is just going to do nothing but sweep her off her feet and rescue her?
Yes. And she loves movies also. She's really fond of movies, and movie magazines.
Yeah. And so like, it makes perfect sense to me that she, the only language she knows how to interact with adult men is romantic language. But I think that there's no way, obviously her mother hasn't given her a birds and the bees talk. Her mother barely even speaks to her. She doesn't have a father. She doesn't even have a brother. Like the only way she knows how to interact with men is how she's learned through movies. And Humbert is just like fantastic. This person who can be easily duped.
Yeah, there is an interesting line in the book where he says, "It was very curious the way she considered and kept doing so for a long time. All caresses except kisses on the mouth were the stark act of love, either, quote, romantic slosh or, quote, abnormal." And I think that is very reflective of what you were just saying. The how we think about romance, or often in romance in film and portrayed in kind of a Hollywood way, is, you know, you've got kissing and you've got fucking,
yeah,
and, you know, fucking in the kind of way that was permitted to be shown in film at the time. But yeah, all the rest she's not interested in, according to him.
Yeah. Like, and also, which is very interesting for the fact that the 1997 version was directed by Adrian Lyne, who is well known for like the erotic thriller in the 1980s, whereas like every single movie that came out in the 1980s that was just like really weird sex scenes where it's just like lots of moaning and grunting and stuff like that. Like that was an Adrian Lyne movie. And then he decides to, I guess, direct Lolita, which has more of that in his version than obviously the Kubrick one could have in the 1960s. But it's such a stark difference between how Lolita understands, or Lo, I don't want to call her Lolita. You know what I mean? It's such a, that's what her abuser called
just
her.
Like Dolores.
Yeah, exactly. Poor Dolores has no idea what sex actually is. So how can she, I mean, she's 12. It's just, I just went off into a uncomprehensible rant right there. I apologize immensely.
It's also really interesting that her name is Dolores. I mean, that is not really a name that I would ever want to give a child.
Nope.
Just like, my name is Bummer.
Yeah,
basically.
Exactly. You know, and all of he.
Sorry
says,
to all the Doloreses out there who are listening.
I don't think there are that many, at least. But you know, he points out that also her friends call her Dolly. You know, mm-hmm. And so she's like, she's a childish plaything when she's actually with her children friends.
Mm-hmm.
Until, especially, I mean, we also have to bring up Quilty, until she is basically stalked by another pedophile.
Yes. Yes.
And her friends know about that one, which is very difficult. And that's when they stop calling her Dolly.
It's interesting how she is just surrounded by gross older men.
Yeah.
In this book. And I think also just the ending is so sad. I mean, when I say ending, I mean the scene where he goes to visit her and she's pregnant and she's essentially consoling him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's very upset. But she is in a new role. She has a lover who is, I think, her age, mm-hmm. and she's pregnant, and
the sad little house.
I believe she's barefoot even. And he's very sad and wants her to leave with him.
Yeah.
Like, he is deluded to the point where he thinks that she might actually leave with him.
Yeah.
And she is like, oh no.
He's waiting patiently, and he's sitting on the floor in front of her, and he's just saying, tell me who it was that stole you from me. You know, like she was an object that someone palmed and pickpocketed and left with. And she just is like, how could you be so dense and not realize it was literally the man I talked about nonstop, you know, because I had a crush on him. I was 12 years old and I was in love with this playwright, which is an odd choice for a 12-year-old. And then he's just like bawling and breaking down, and he's begging her to say, like, please tell me that what I did to you was okay. And she just basically goes, oh, honey, no. And he kicks him out.
Yeah. Can I read you? Can I just
please
read
do.
This little tiny section? So Humbert says, I'll die if you touch me. I said, you are sure you're not coming with me? Is there no hope if you're coming? Tell me only this. No, she said. No, honey, no. She had never called me honey before. No, she said. It is quite out of the question. I would sooner go back to Pew. I mean, she groped for words. I supplied them mentally. He broke my heart. You merely broke my life.
People who dismiss this book as smut can't, I just clearly don't see the obvious pain that Lo is in throughout the book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's beautiful for the fact that she is never the subject and always the object.
Mm-hmm.
It's phenomenal writing.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually had someone, or that someone was actually Jenny Zhang, the poet and writer, read a part of Lolita at my wedding ceremony.
That's a bold choice.
It is a bold choice. Family. It's a weird and bold choice. But yeah, we actually, we had decided not to have a Catholic ceremony. So instead we had a bunch of readings from literature, and I created a little zine instead of a program that had the excerpts as well as our little write-ups of why we had chosen them.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I remember we had written in the little zine thing, like, this is going to seem like a very odd choice, but there is a section from Lolita in this ceremony. And I think we talked about kind of the obsessiveness of love. And anyway, the Aurochs and Angels, just like the last, it's from the last few paragraphs. Mm-hmm. We had her read. And I think of all the things that I appreciate of this book, of which there are many, it will always be the prose first and foremost. You can always count on a murderer for a fancy prose style.
This book actually takes one of my favorite literary formats. I know this is going to sound very weird, but the prison confession is one of my favorite literary formats. My favorite book is Mother Night by Kurt Vonnegut, which is about a Nazi, you know, confessing all of his war crimes. So for some reason, it gives me a very strange reaction to read the internal conflicts of bad men. Because there is such a push and pull between Humbert in this, where he cannot tamp down the lust, and I think in his understanding of it, love that he has for Dolores, with the knowing that he hurt her in a way that no other person could. It is a constant battle in his head that I don't think people really give him a lot of, or the character a lot of credit for. And Nabokov, you know, whose name I always butcher, they don't give him enough credit for the fact that Humbert is a very conflicted person throughout the entire story.
Yeah, as he tries to convince himself that Quilty is so much worse than he is. But I mean, Dolores claims to have loved him, which she never did for Humbert.
Yeah, yeah. It's the only moment where she's given any kind of real power over him, because she knows it's going to hurt him. She knows it's going to injure him. And she does it anyway. She says it anyway.
Yeah. And also to think about, you know, her escape from the hospital with Quilty, she actually has very little power in that scenario as well.
Yeah.
It's another older man who is also perverse and wanting to, you know, harm her. But she's using him as an avenue of escape from this other person that she sees as worse.
Yeah, the ability these men have to play society like a fiddle. They all always know what to say to get everyone to do what they want. And there's so many moments too when you're reading this where you can tell that society knows something bad is happening. Like the doctor that he's asking for sleeping pills, when you read it, the doctor is just kind of like, really, you need stronger knockout drugs? Like, what is happening here? And then he essentially gives him placebos, like pills that don't work. And whether or not that's knowing or just like a glitch of the pharmacological makeup of the pill, I'd like to think that it's knowing that he gave Humbert these pills that don't actually knock anybody out. So he can't.
The per pills.
Exactly. you know, he gives them placebos and bunkum pills. And it's, you hope that other people are trying to thwart him, but he seems to overpower them at every turn.
It's interesting too how he completely loses it at the hospital. And after he realizes that Dolores is gone, and he is not arrested, or he's able to talk his way out of the situation in a way that I think another kind of person would not be able to.
Yeah. That's a very good point. That's another scene that's indicated very well in the Jeremy Irons movie. He's literally like beating the head doctor's head into the floor, and then he's just allowed to leave. And he's always given a pass that other people would not ever be given. Not Dolores, whose, you know, teachers are just kind of like, oh, she's weird, like, better, you know, marry her off quickly. The other parents are just like, I don't want my daughter hanging out with her. Dolores is given a lot of punishment in a way that Humbert never is.
Another kind of fuckboy slash villain aspect of the book that is often not acknowledged is what happens with Rita after he loses Dolores. She's described as, she was twice Lolita's age and 3/4 of mine, a very slight, dark-haired, pale-skinned adult, weighing 105 pounds with charmingly asymmetrical eyes, an angular, rapidly sketched profile. He says, she was so kind, was Rita, such a good sport, that I dare say she would have given herself to any pathetic creature of fallacy, an old broken tree or a bereaved porcupine, out of sheer chumminess and compassion.
He loves, you know, if he has to deign spend time with adult women, they are almost always malleable, childish-looking women.
Mm-hmm.
And he, yes. and they should be, you know, of course, everybody should be treated better in this book because he's the one of the worst abusers ever caught in fiction. But at the same time, like, he has no respect for grown adult women. None.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, he doesn't. I think deigns to spend time with them is a good way to describe. She was the sweetest, simplest, gentlest, dumbest Rita imaginable.
It's like he's describing a dog.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's also an addict, which is something that, you know, he doesn't come out and say, but he will point out the fact that she, like, takes something and then sleeps for 12 hours and you know, she'll run off and do something and come back with, like, money that he can't figure out how she got. And he doesn't seem concerned for her in any way, shape, or form, though.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's one of the most interesting and, you know, I read a lot of books for this show where the main character is obsessed with the ways that they have been wronged. You know, the first thing that comes to my mind is Jude the Obscure. And, you know, there's quite a number of men in Middlemarch that just ruminate on all the wonderful hopes and dreams that they had for themselves that they never were handed to on a platter. But Humbert is one of those characters where it's frustrating that he actually did the work to get what he wanted. It's just what he wanted was terrible.
Yes. Yes. And I think I might be reading too much into it, but I feel like he kind of knows he's pathetic, you know, and in the way that he is constantly addressing this, I think, imaginary jury. It's like, I'm throwing myself on the hands of the court. I'm throwing myself at your mercy as I describe all of these horrible things that I did.
He also just so begrudgingly mentions his past time in institutions where he has gotten medical help, or at the time what was medical help for what he views as a problem, which is his obsession with young girls. But he is so incredibly humiliated by it that he beats himself up almost physically when he lets it slip, you know, to other people that he had been in an institution. And it's not the fear that someone will find out his predilections, because he is known to have these predilections by people in the book. It's the fear that people will find out that he's gotten medical attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He likes to think of himself as an intellect and a professor and someone who looks like a movie star and might have happened to be institutionalized a few times here and there, but would rather not talk about it.
And, you know, even after he kills Quilty, there's a moment where he describes, you know, coming out of the house and being in shock and having just like not being able to control how he feels or how he maneuvers his car and things like mm-hmm. that. And he describes it as, oh, I made the choice just to drive on the wrong side of the street and, you know, basically plow my car into a field and narrowly missing cows. And it's just like, I made that choice. It's like, no, you're suffering from shock because you just murdered someone in cold blood and your child girlfriend dumped you. And like but he always has to feel like he's in control in a way that I feel like literary villains just feel like control is natural and theirs, whereas the fuckboy is like always grasping for it and reaching for it in a way, in a different manner.
That's a really interesting delineation. And I'm also thinking about that particular scene in the Jeremy Irons film, because that is very clearly depicted. The car swerves. Mm-hmm. It is weaving in and out. He does drive into a field. There, I think, are cows or sheep or something like that. And he just kind of stumbles out of the car. And there's no sense, I think, because we don't get a sense of his interiority as we do in the novel, that he thinks he's in control or that he knows what he's doing. It very much comes more across as he's in shock. He doesn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. He's just going to kind of stumble out of the car, and while the police are in pursuit and
lazily in pursuit. Another moment where he's granted a gift that no other person on earth would be granted, just simply because of the way he looks. This is an absolutely fascinating book to read as an adult if you're aware it won't trigger you in a mm-hmm. deeply negative way, because I can imagine that there are many people that it would. But if you feel you can handle it, give it another reread, because it's just an absolutely disturbingly beautiful book.
Yes, disturbingly beautiful is a good way to describe it. I think it's also just an interesting book to come to at different points in one's life. As I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, just I think my personal levels of disgust and repulsion have shifted in interesting ways. Not that I become less repulsed by him, but just the nature of my repulsion really changes, has changed over the decades, and especially since I first read it as a teenager.
I also got so much extra context. Just the copy that I have has basically an afterword written by the author. And there's a certain point where he says, like, I do not write didactic novels. I didn't write this to teach you about anything or to be taught about anything. I just wanted to tell a story. And I don't know if people can grasp the idea that you can write a book about deeply, deeply flawed and abhorrent people and actions, and not be someone who's wanting to like tisk tisk biblically moralize about it. He is really just presenting a deeply obsessive man and his downfall.
Yeah, that is an interesting thing that my partner, who teaches high school English, is attempting to teach about reading, either poetry or prose, just we're discussing the different ways that students can interpret pieces of writing. And we were talking about how so often when we were younger, we were taught that poems or prose or whatever were like puzzle boxes and you mm-hmm. had to figure out the mystery. And so one of the ways he has his students interpret pieces is through the emotional response, which I think is interesting.
I wish that I had
that kind of lens through which to appreciate literature when I was younger.
I get into that discussion a lot on Twitter where people really think you're not allowed to have the first reaction of this book is bad. And I understand how when you are first learning how to sit with literature on a personal level, of course your first reaction to things like, you know, this or Jude the Obscure or something, and you're just going to be like, man, that was bad. It made me feel a lot of really terrible things. And it's like, oh, okay, that's the next step. And I feel like constantly telling people who may not have gone through like many, many, many years of literary education that no, you're never allowed to call a book bad really kind of nips in the bud people's emotional response and emotional relationship with literature. Like, you're allowed to have negative feelings about a book. It's fine. Mm-hmm. It's great, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. Having any feelings about a book or about literature is great. In my opinion. And one thing that I did want to add is that I highly recommend for people getting your hands on the annotated edition, because not all authors have as many Easter eggs and French and Latin, etc., as Nabokov does. But this book is full of references to things. And I was just saying that literature is not a puzzle necessarily, but in some ways, he has put in a lot of puzzles, and it is really delightful to have the annotated editions so that you can kind of see these little things that he sprinkled here and there.
It adds to the playfulness of understanding that Humbert thinks this is a love story. Where he's having a lot of fun in the narrative that he's writing, like down to the fact that the one that I caught this go round, I didn't catch it when I was 20 and very much looking forward to graduating, was the fact that his childhood girl that he's in love with is named Annabel Lee.
Right.
Like the Edgar Allan Poe poem also about a child bride. It's very winky in a way that you don't want it to be. And it adds to the fuckboy nature of Humbert, where he's just like, I know how smart I am. I know how playful I'm being. I know how many little Easter eggs I'm putting in there. But at the same time, this is not a moment where I want you to find the Bible verse that condemns me. I'm going to make a reference to past literary brilliance who also might have had questionable relationships with young women, or the French. He makes so many like Rimbaud and Baudelaire references, and it's it's very rococo in the people that it also references.
Yes, I mean, in the annotations, it mentions, to get back to the Annabel Lee thing, Poe is referred to more than any other writer. He's referred to more than 20 times in the book, which is a lot.
That's a lot.
I do want to, because you were talking about how Humbert thinks of this as a love story. I want to ask you if you have also seen this blurb about this book that is on so many editions. It's not on the one that I'm currently looking at, so I can't refer to it. But there's a very famous blurb that is often on this book that says something like, it's the great love story of of the 20th century, or something like that. And I just find that so weird.
Who? And I try to find it because, my God, why would you ever do that?
Yeah, it's often like on the cover or like the back cover. I just remember seeing it often. I don't remember who said it, but
I'm gonna see if I can look it up.
Anyway, it's just yeah. Anyway,
that's someone who didn't read the book before they blurbed it, I guess. Maybe. The great literary critic Lionel Trilling identified the novel as the greatest love story of our time.
Yes, that is the one I am thinking of, I think.
Wow. Humbert thinks it is.
I mean, I just, in looking for the quote, I scrolled down and saw the headline of something else from crimereads.com. Lolita isn't a love story. It's a gothic horror novel.
Do you have Jane Eyre? My guest on the Jane Eyre episode was also just like, you do realize this is a YA horror novel, right? And I was like, oh, that changes my relationship to it immensely. Yeah. It is a gothic horror novel. Oh, I'm going to sit with that for a little while.
Yeah, that Lionel Trilling quote is on so many copies of this book, and I just find that so bizarre, you know, and weird.
My friend Kristen, she mentioned that she just would really like to see a Lolita adaptation done by women, and I can't disagree.
I mean, there was that book that was from Lolita's perspective. Do you remember this? It came out in like the 90s. And I think it was like vaguely popular. It was written by a woman, though, I believe. But I, more than that, and I never read it just because it never seemed that interesting to me in flipping through it. But I would really love to see an adaptation of Nabokov's book by a woman. I think that would be really interesting.
There's a book called Lowe's Diary, which is by an Italian writer named Pia Pera, which is from her perspective. I'd never heard of it before, but I might pick it up after this because I'm afraid that if someone writes basically Lolita's internal monologue, there might be I haven't read this book, but my fear would be that someone would try to make it so Lo feels special, you know, in some way by this attention. Whereas I feel like a film adaptation of Nabokov, I always pronounce it.
I once asked a Ukrainian friend of mine how to pronounce his name. And so I've just been saying Nabokov my whole life, but I've also heard it pronounced other ways by people who are fancy and know things.
Gotcha.
So I don't know if I'm right.
From the original text, I will now say, because I will stop being goofy, I would love to see a film adaptation of the original text done by people who have been marginalized and not just by white straight men. That would just be very, very nice.
Yeah. Oh. I'm putting that into the universe. Somebody do that.
Please help us. Help us bring this incredible book properly to screen. Esme, thank you so much for being on this show with me. I cannot thank you enough. This was a wonderful conversation.
Oh, thank you so much for chatting with me about one of my favorite books and a book that is hard to talk about. So thank you.
I hope we did well, but how can everybody keep in touch with you and your work and future announcements about reprints and new publications?
Yes. So I have a website that is quite robust at esmewang.com. You can subscribe to my newsletter at esmewang.com/subscribe. And I also run a membership community for ambitious writers with illness and disability at unexpectedshapecommunity.com.